are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, July 18th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ben Burgess, author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. Can the Democratic debates get better from the perspective of having public debates that actually facilitate better discussion? We'll talk about that, how the lies and propaganda against Medicare for All are sold, the case for why Sanders truly represents something distinct, new, different, and significantly better. Also, the Brazil coup and logical fallacies. A lot to do with Ben Burgess. Is that better? Also on today's program, Donald Trump. His base wants a race war. He'll give it to them, rhetorically. Will the Democrats fight back? Well, of course, a lot of them won't, but we will. We will stand with Ilhan. And will most normal Americans see what these people are doing and side against bigotry? The House holds William Barr and Wilbur Ross in criminal contempt. Ilhan Omar with the most, she's just incredible. She introduces a resolution affirming the right of people to participate in a boycott.
Not even specifically about BDS.
Not even specifically about BDS against Israel, just in general, because the anti-BDS bills are unconstitutional. Rand Paul, he's terrible, but in this totally unnecessary crisis created by Trump with Iran, he might be the administration's envoy to Iran. And so, with one hand give, the other hand take away, Rand Paul, minding everybody he's a sociopath by holding up the 9/11 compensation fund single-handedly. Thousands are protesting right now in Puerto Rico against a massive disclosure of corruption and much else against the Puerto Rican governor and his cabinet. Amazon's facing a crackdown from the European Union. Glenn Greenwald and The Intercept are still disclosing new corruption revelations against Sergio Moro and the Lava Jato team that made Lula da Silva a political prisoner, and the Bolsonaro government is apparently deeply targeting Glenn Greenwald. Solidarity with him. And Bernie Sanders and Ilhan Omar. Ilhan Omar is quite busy. Have asked the Department of Labor to investigate Amazon warehouses and young people move forward in a federal suit against the federal government on climate change, how it's risked their futures. And the U.S. government has known that it would be a problem going back to the 1960s. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. I do want to say just programmatically, we had a great guest. Ben Burgess is an amazing guest. Obviously, he's a regular on TMBS. So, I mean, you know, sometimes there's the same guests. They go back and forth in between both shows, obviously. But I've had Ben on this show to talk about his great book. But we had a guest. She was going to talk about why Biden care is a disaster, why we need Medicare for all. But there was a significant travel problem. So that will be rebooked. But I'm stoked to speak to Ben Burgess. And thanks for responding to my text, Ben. A little bit of some behind-the-scenes action here, folks. We need to get to this. there is a huge amount of inbuilt cynicism about Donald Trump, about his racism, about his bigotry. The three lines here of response are actually really basic to just the racism in and of itself. There's a group of people that crave it and want it and affirm it. That's his base. That's the Republican Party. There is a continuum of people that spans, they might sound rhetorically different at times, but there's a lot of quote-unquote never-Trump Republicans. There's Chuck Todd types. There's Democratic leaders like Pelosi and so on who might, you know, moralistically condemn or hector or, you know, strongly wag their finger at it, but do nothing of substance or seriousness to actually combat it strategically. And then there's those of us, and right now, you know, obviously the lead is these four leaders in Congress. Bernie Sanders has obviously also been incredibly unequivocal about this. And I say Bernie Sanders because he's talking specifically about these four leaders. I mean, that's a really distinguishing thing that you can find. All of the Democratic candidates and so on will put out statements against xenophobia and against hate and so on. But this has a face. This has a specific target list. It's Rashida Tlaib, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and most significantly and most drastically and most grotesquely, Ilhan Omar. This is Bernie Sanders yesterday. It starts exactly with the simplest point. Hashtag, I stand with Ilhan, and I'm proud to work with her in Congress. Trump is stoking the most despicable and disturbing currents in our society, and that very hatred and racism fuels him. We must fight together to defeat the most dangerous president in the history of our country. Now, again, and it's not just because I support Sanders. If other candidates were leading with the hashtag, or congressional leaders for that matter, I would give them the same props. But it just needs to be very clear that that is how we start. We don't start with some broad, big picture, and, you know, certainly none of the "this isn't who we are" Joe Biden pablum. We go with, this is one of America's most important young leaders, someone who's incidentally incredibly physically courageous. Elizabeth Warren, this is really important.
30 minutes ago.
And I was saying this because as of last night, Elizabeth Warren had not done this. But she did it, so now I'm very happy to give her props right now. This is Elizabeth Warren. Hashtag, I stand with Hashtag, I stand with Ilhan against attacks from this racist president, and we should all remember this definition of patriotism. And then she quote tweets an excellent video from Now This by an excellent congresswoman and leader, Ilhan Omar, from Now This. But it's, maybe we could play that later. But the point is great. So Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, of the candidates I'm aware of now, have been the ones that have used the hashtag and have spoken directly and clearly.
Mm-hmm. I'll just say, and earlier in the week before this, before Trump really went in on the Ilhan stuff, when the squad stuff was going on, Cory Booker also said something about the four. And it's amazing what running for president can do to a Democrat these days.
It's pretty amazing, because let us never forget that the Democratic leadership, the failed, sclerotic, utterly unfit for purpose Democratic leadership, people like Nancy Pelosi and Hakeem Jeffries, have spent more time and the just unbelievably odious and grotesque Rahm Emanuel manages to pop up in this as well. I guess he's not House leadership, obviously. But they've spent more time backbiting, briefing against, and trying to damage these four leaders than actually even taking on Trump, let alone seriously pushing a progressive agenda. So, and now it's circled against Ilhan. It's circled against Ilhan both because, look, incredibly easy source of extreme bigotry and racism. She's a Somali refugee. She's a Muslim. She wears a headscarf. I mean, these things are really obvious. And I think it's also because, and I don't mean this to, you know, all four of these leaders are incredibly important and courageous, and they all bring different distinct things to the table. I think we actually saw yesterday or the day before the way Ayanna Pressley was able to synthesize her attack on Trump with a very clear indirect articulation of how Nancy Pelosi was playing and what she saw and how she was going to follow up on it. Rashida Tlaib has always been someone I've been a huge fan of and has a grassroots background and is DSA and has been very clear, partially obviously as a result of her, you know, heritage as a Palestinian, about, you know, being clear about the occupation and the abuses of the Palestinian people. And AOC obviously has an extraordinary amount of star power and has used her platform in a number of incredibly important ways on climate, on credit cards, on the Green New Deal. And I would, and to me, frankly, most significantly, and all of them now kind of cohering most significantly right now, on the concentration camps and the issues of this Gestapo tactics at the border. But Ilhan Omar, in addition to her fearlessness on calling out the coup mongering of this administration in Venezuela, with the complicity and the support of Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi and Engel and so on, she does not flinch. She does not back down. And best believe that this woman's life is endangered. And this is, you know, this is the clown fascist in chief. This is the idiot. He knows what he's doing. And, you know, generic rejection of it isn't going to work. Here he is in North Carolina yesterday,
saying some people did something. I don't think so. Some people did something. Yeah, some people did something. All right. She pleaded for compassion for ISIS.
She meant some people did something that not every single Muslim should have to answer for.
That was precisely the point. Exactly. He's referring to a statement that Ilhan Omar made in the context of talking about Muslim civil liberties and civil rights after 9/11. And her point was precisely that, yes, a specific terrorist group committed a specific terrorist atrocity. And then the policies that flowed out of that in terms of the invasion of civil liberties, not to mention the millions of lives taken overseas, has spilled out into many of the world's Muslims who had nothing to do with that event. It's quite simple, but obviously Donald Trump's going to twist it.
ISIS recruits attempting to join the terrorist organization. She was looking for compassion. Omar laughed that Americans speak of Al-Qaeda in a menacing tone and remarked that you don't say America with this intensity. You say Al-Qaeda makes you proud. Al-Qaeda makes you proud. You don't speak that way about America.
Pause it. If I understand what he's referring to, I think this was actually her point of saying your pride and your energy should be in your country, not a ragtag terrorist group. And I'm going to do red, white, and blue and agree with her on that. I think you should have a lot more intensity and excitement about the potential and possibility of a complicated, flawed, but also very promising place that Ilhan Omar has done more in her life and even just her time here than Donald Trump. I mean, not only than Donald Trump has ever had. Donald Trump is doing everything he can to harm and undermine this country and the planet, obviously. So I agree with her. I think it would be much better if you want to build an identity in relationship to your country to have a positive and proactive one, and one that isn't neurotically obsessed with a disgusting terrorist organization that almost certainly none of the idiots in this audience will ever have to deal with. And by the way, you know, Ilhan Omar, groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, nobody do they hate more than an Ilhan Omar. In fact, if you look at their strategy documents, there's a really, I think it's called the Management of Savagery, which is a strategy document that I think it was emerged from Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but it's been a blueprint for ISIS. A big part, and Osama bin Laden as well, a huge part of their game plan has been empowering George W. Bush's, Donald Trump's, the European far right. That is precisely the tactics, along with lone wolf terrorist actions, that they see as most effective for growing their toxic ideology and enhancing their influence. So if anything, Donald Trump is an incredible, incredible benefit to these people.
And we also have this picture of a speech a couple days earlier where Trump was spelling Al-Qaeda, A-L-C-A-I-D-A. So he's clearly an expert on who
That does not sound to me like he takes Al-Qaeda as seriously as he needs to. Fucking buffoon. All right, let's finish this.
And at a press conference just this week, when asked whether she supported Al-Qaeda, that's our enemy. That's our enemy. They are a very serious problem that we take care of, but they always seem to come along somewhere. She refused to answer. She didn't want to give an answer to that question. Omar blamed...
Because she shouldn't have to.
...the United States for the crisis in Venezuela. I mean, think of that one. And she looks down with contempt on the hard-working Americans, saying that ignorance is pervasive in many parts of this country.
Just one other thing to say here. I mean, one is the obvious point that somebody who's the co-sponsor of Medicare for All, student debt cancellation, wants to investigate Amazon warehouses, and so on, obviously is doing infinitely more for working people of every single background in this country than Donald Trump, who's the enemy of the working class, white, brown, black, and everywhere. But this is the other really bizarre dual impulse of American white supremacy and racism, because there's even though Trump, you know, obviously is, you know, kind of a, you know, sort of an idiot and an oaf in some ways, despite his, you know, instincts for demagoguery, his sort of backroom chat is, I want high IQ people. And the sort of, you know, the pseudoscience, the smart person test, the Charles Murray, the genteel pseudoscientific racism, the I want people from Norway stuff. But then on the flip side, there's this, you know, you're an uneducated, you know, you're probably not particularly well read and so on. And again, it's very interesting because those are frankly the quality. Judging people by where they went to school, judging people by their cultural currency, how they present themselves, and certainly judging people by some dumb test metric, trash, reject it, period. But obviously we can make estimations about people's intellectual curiosity, what they choose to investigate and inquire about their own. I mean, you know, just to hand the example, but the gentleman who called in last week, he's a farmer. It's like, yeah, I farm and I like to watch and learn things. That has nothing to do with any kind of like nonsense social capital game, which is what repulses a lot of people about what is called like the coastal elites, right? Because it's not about genuine intellectual inquiry. It's about where you went to college and all this crap, which is in fact crap.
And how you can purvey that into a massive income.
And how you can, exactly. But this is speaking to an attitude of, I don't want to know. I don't want to talk to people. I don't want to read books. I don't want to enlarge my scope of understanding the world, which anybody can do. And most of those elites, by the way, do not have an enlarged scope of the world at all. They just have a narrow elite one. But what he's speaking to, though, is that duality, where on one hand, we're white, we're racist, we dismiss other people. And then on the other hand, you know, look at Ilan, like she's global, she's sophisticated, she's clearly hyper articulate, she's well read, she's got an intelligence, she has a savvy to her. Well, to hell with that. She looks down on you. And that's the duality. And there's no contradiction in these people's minds, because both is filling feeding on the historical continuity of the mythology of essentialization and race and white identity politics, but it's also just filling enormous psychological and emotional vacuums in these people, which need to be filled by either inflation or deflation because of their identity. But anyways, finish it.
And obviously and importantly, Omar has a history of launching vicious anti-Semitic screeds.
Lies.
Lie.
This is what fascism sounds like.
And she talked about the evil Israel, and it's all about the Benjamins. Not a good thing to say. So, that's Omar. That's Omar. And by the way, many other things. All you have to do is press the right button on your beautiful screen.
So, yeah, they chanted, send her back, send her back. Been saying for a while now, obviously, Trump's 2016 campaign was dishonest, racist, xenophobic, misogynist, everything. And then there was a scam and hustle about protecting people's economic interests. But because he's a Republican, he governs against the 99% economic interest. So all he has left is this. And not the people. I absolutely think that there was a small but statistically significant percentage of people who voted for Trump because of those economic things. They're gone. You actually can measure that in the midterms, particularly in the Midwest. But we got to be real that a significant part of the Republican base, this is what they want. And
this is also what the system is has been sent up for centuries to deliver.
Precisely. And it is disgusting. And it is, you know, it's every adjective expressing moral condemnation you have is all appropriate for that. And as Mehdi Hasan tweeted today, they're trying to get her killed. We don't need to flinch about what this collective action is. And the only response to it is there are no sidelines. You are 100% with Ilhan Omar, period. Obviously, it doesn't mean you can have political debates, you can disagree, whatever, that's fine. But the fundamental thing that this is a leader, this is a congressperson, this is someone of an immense courage and integrity that we support 100%. We fight against the lies and smears about her. You're going to be hearing a lot more about a lot of crackpot theories that, you know, just like birtherism began in the worst of the right-wing swamps, they're going to get spread through those networks. They're going to correlate with the president, obviously. You have a troll as president. There's no difference between him and anybody, you know, anybody spreading a lie on social media. And then the broader struggle here is getting and acquiring power and using that power to materially defeat the conditions of this politics, and then also understanding that, in fact, your role as a politician is actually also a cultural one. And that's why there can be absolutely zero ambiguity about ruthlessly fighting back against this stuff every shape or form, every shape and form. And there is no room for ambiguity right now in clear anti-racism and in the very specific character of support for these four leaders as they're terrorized. And Ilhan Omar has always been, you know, precisely because she has been willing to criticize Israel, precisely because there are a few comments, one, you know, from 2012, which you can, you know, take out of context or distort. And also precisely because she's actually shown her own willingness to evolve and improve, which, you know, Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump sure as hell don't show.
Or Ben Shapiro, for that matter.
Oh, Ben Shapiro is another one. Don't let, you know, Ben Shapiro, we got to go in a second, but Ben Shapiro, watch him very closely right now, because his move right now is, oh, well, that's terrible. You know, the president can't say that. She's a vicious anti-Semite. So he's going to continue to lie and smear about her and set the context for hate while he tries to pivot his brand against the actual incitement against
him. Yeah, leave he's the paper
doing
trail.
He's doing the same thing in reality, whether he knows it or not. That's what it is. And there's a reason why, whatever his intentions are, there's a reason why you know, he's up there on those grids when some terrorist attacks a mosque. So let's be clear about this and have her back. We're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back with Ben Burgess.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful, a miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they be singing so happily, oh, joyfully, oh, playfully, watching me. But then they sent me.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Ben Burgess. He's author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, available now. Get it immediately. You can also go to Ben's Patreon page and get essays and recordings and all sorts of other content from Ben. He's also the regular on the Debunk on TMBS as well. Ben, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Ben, just more broadly, I mean, we got some Democratic debates coming up at the end of the month. The lineups were released yesterday. It looks like I don't actually know. They've tried to sort of mix things up a little bit more, so you don't have the same kind of stack effect that you had a couple of weeks ago, where you had, you know, all of the main contenders with the exception of Elizabeth Warren on one stage, and then Warren, you know, on stage with the sort of more, you know, generally kind of more marginal candidates. Debates are bad, and especially Democratic debates, because they don't have the sort of like insane carnival grotesque aspect of Republican debates, which can be just, you know, just sort of like late Roman crumbling empire entertainment. But they're still entertainment. They still actually don't have really all that much substance. What, as a logic professor, like, what could actually facilitate those things being more substantive, more worthwhile?
Yeah. So our mutual friend David Feldman always says that, you know, you should it should be more like a Senate hearing where the moderators are like inquisitors, and I've never been quite sure what to think about that, because of course, that just gives more power to the sort of narratives that are being pushed by the big corporate media venues that are hosting these things. But I will say that the way that moderators ask follow-up questions is really unhelpful in the format that we've got now, right? Because it's just really superficial. That, you know, right now, it's, you know, you'll get follow-up questions like, you know, Bernie Sanders says Rachel Maddow was misrepresenting him on gun control, which she actually was, by the way. And she'll follow up, said, no, that's a quote, right? You know, like, so you have this kind of he said, she said about trivia, you know, and there'll be a little bit of fact checking, but you don't really get meaningful follow up questions about the content of what they're saying. And so I think that if you're going to have a debate, and by the way, another thing that you could do would be to really dramatically reduce the number of people on stage. It's just not helpful to have 12 people up there. And I feel a little weird and anti-democratic about saying that, but, you know, it really does.
I was going to say, there's going to be a certain contingent that's going to be like, ugh, he says he's a socialist.
Yeah, no. I mean, if you got rid of the total cranks advocating UBI and stuff like that, you know, it's just has to be the main candidates up there.
Turn off your mentions.
That would be very helpful. Seriously, like, because you have so many people up there, it's very hard to, you know, everything's kind of a mile wide and an inch deep. And it would be very helpful if when, you know, you probably need a different kind of moderator for that, because the sort of media hacks that you have doing this, I don't think would necessarily be very good at this, for the most part, with some exceptions. Mm-hmm. But if you had moderators who would say, hold on, what you just said, I'm not, you know, that doesn't really make sense, right? Or you say this, or you say this, what about this? You know, that would be much more helpful than just kind of trying to pin people down into things they can do sound bites about.
Is it also the fact that, and some of this goes back to Tim Russert, who's actually been passed away for a while now, but his methodology on Meet the Press was all about, it was like, it doesn't matter what the merit or substance of anything is. All that matters is the contradiction. So, in other words, like, actually, a good example of this would be John McCain. So, when George W. Bush was first elected, and I do think because John McCain was pretty much like a purely ego-driven politician, he was super pissed still because – and. Absolutely, George W. Bush's campaign did run an incredibly dirty and, in fact, you know, totally racist campaign in South Carolina against him. And he both was had a national brand that had built up, and especially in that, you know, in 2000, still very post-ideological space. So, you know, the terrain was sort of like, you know, third-way Democrat, compassionate conservative. So he got a huge amount of love from the so-called liberal media. And, you know, he had a grievance and a brand. And so in the beginning of the Bush administration, you could read there was a couple years there where he, you know, he voted against the Bush era tax cuts. And he actually said specifically at the time it was because they favored the wealthy. They weren't going to be good for, you know, middle class and working people. He voted against Bush on some environmental initiatives and other things. I mean, obviously not on war. You know, John McCain was totally never willing to compromise. You know, he could set aside a personal grievance when it came to an imperial adventure that would kill millions of people, obviously. So I don't want to deprive the man of that. But that being said,
sure,
Tim Russert,
probably the only reason that we haven't invaded Iran yet is that Trump realizes that, you know, it's John McCain's dying wish.
Right, exactly. That is actually super deep. That's actually probably exactly why we haven't debated Iran yet. That's the best theory I've heard. So, but then, you know, when McCain remade himself after 2004 back into a conventional hard right conservative to run for president in 2008 and, you know, embraced all of, you know, trickle down economics and everything. So the Russert method and the method of even the moderators of the Democratic debate wouldn't be like, you know, why have you changed this policy set? And, you know, are your interests different now? And now are you actually just into rewarding wealthy people and increasing inequality? Have you, moved back to the right philosophically? It would just be, well, you were here then, and now you're here now. That's a contradiction, and that's it. Gotcha.
Yes. No, exactly. Because that makes for a really cheap, really easy soundbite, you know, to say, hey, here's what, you know, you can play what he said back then, you can play what he said now, it's superficially embarrassing. And look, if somebody is saying something interesting and you think you can catch them in an inconsistency, that might actually go somewhere. But, you know, when it comes to stuff like this, it's a total diversion from actually exploring the substance of it. And, you know, like, how much better would it have been if people had been interviewing John McCain in 2008 and they had been, like, really challenging him on the merits of invading Iraq and staying there for 100 years, which he once, you know, infamously said that he'd be willing to do. like actually digging into that and how he's, you know, continued to stand by it after everything that had happened. That would have been a public service, just sort of catching him on the fact that he changed his mind and seeing if he has a smooth explanation of that is just theater. And it's not even really very good theater.
So that brings me, then what is the relationship between rhetoric and logic?
Yeah, so logic is about giving good reasons for beliefs that, you know, I want you to agree with me. I'm going to give you a reason to agree with me. Or I'm even thinking about, even if there's not another person involved, I'm just thinking about what the correct position is. And I'm like weighing different reasons for thinking one thing versus thinking another thing, what the evidence is. Whereas rhetoric is about how you package that. And when I say that, the point is not at all to, you know, to dump on rhetoric. I think rhetoric is really important. And oftentimes there are lots of people on the left I wish paid more attention to it. But logic is about the substance of your arguments. Rhetoric is about how you present your arguments, and they're both important. But I think that oftentimes, the lane that I'm interested in is mostly about actually getting the arguments right. But of course, you also want to package them in the most effective, compelling way possible if you're interested in political outcomes, because otherwise, what's the point, right? You know, you want to convince as many people as possible. So you want to put it in the package rhetorically that is going to convince as many people as possible. But if you've just got rhetoric and there's no good underlying argument, then it's just kind of pointless. Then it's a box with some really, with some really nice wrapping paper on it, but nothing inside.
Has anybody done more to confuse logic with rhetoric than Ben Shapiro?
Probably not. I think we discussed when I was on the show the first time, his book, 11 Rules for Arguing with Leftists and Destroying Them, which, God, I just love that so much, right? You know, you just get this image from that title of some Ben Shapiro arguing with some big leftist, Zizek or Chomsky or somebody, and, right, that guy just having to be carried out as a stretcher because Shapiro just destroyed him. But then, if you read that book, 9 of the 11 rules are just about how to frame the argument. Make sure that people are talking about this and not this, and that you're walking into the fire as far as what they're giving you, and that you don't let them, change the subject to accusing you of being a racist, which is a problem apparently he has a lot for some reason.
yeah, I wonder why. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But it's I think 1.5 of the rules actually have anything to do with logic, right? Even though this is the guy the New York Times called the destroyer of weak arguments. There's one rule that's about, spot inconsistencies in the other person's position. And all the examples he has are, ridiculously superficial, like stuff on the level of, they say they care about people dying, but then they support abortion, just ridiculous stuff like that. So right, there's a drop of attempt, in the ocean of rhetorical framing, there's a little eyedropper drop of attempt to actually engage with the substance of arguments.
And yeah, right. And then that leads to the, if I grant you global warming and the oceans start to, flood people's homes, you could just sell them. Right.
Ben
Shapiro logic par excellence. If your beachfront property is flooded because of global warming, just flip it on the market.
Yeah, that's right. And the thing is, as ridiculous as he is, he's loud, he's fast, he's confident, which means that most people I hope some of them had this thought immediately, but probably a lot of the people who listen to him say that didn't think until much later, oh, wait a second, hold on, Ben, you're selling it to who?
Right. You had some real frustration specifically in the debates with misframes and lies about Medicare for All.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So a lot of this has to do, and it's actually kind of interesting to see the evolution of this, because in 2016, the big objection that Hillary made to Medicare for All was that it would involve raising taxes. And you still got a little bit of that this time, right? Like one of the questions that Bernie was given in the first debate was about getting him to admit, as if he's ever denied it, that taxes would be raised to pay for it. And of course, he made the obvious point that, sure, you're going to raise taxes, but the overall cost for a middle-income family of their current tax burden plus private insurance premium is going to be less than the cost of the raised taxes, which is all that should matter. But that's not the main line of attack this time around. It seems like this time the line of scrimmage has shifted to all this stuff about, well, what about people who like their health insurance? You're taking away health insurance from people who like it. You know, what about all the people who love it, who say, you know, we've always been a Blue Cross Blue Shield family. It would break my heart.
Ben, I'm long supported Medicare for All, mostly because I've gone years without having health insurance and also because of my values. But damn, Oscar as a company has done so much to evoke brand loyalty in me. It's gotten a lot harder.
I know. I
mean, the way that they make it slightly less financially calamitous for basic coverage, it just is like, God, what would happen to them?
I know, right. So you know, okay, why are you taking away, you know, health, you know, if people like their health insurance, then, you know, then they should be able to keep it. You know, why not just have, you know, Medicare for All who want it?
Right.
You know, just have something that is in the exchanges, which everybody hates because normal human beings hate having to fill out forms and compare the fine print on different plans. But, you know, have an option on the exchanges that you label Medicare for All and that you're going to charge some kind of premium for, but it'll be run by the government. You know, that's good enough, right? What's wrong with that? And of course, one thing that's wrong with that is that people, one of the great advantages of socialized systems for healthcare, whether it's, you know, Medicare for All like Canada or a fully socialized system like the UK, is that you don't have to think about it,
right?
That you never have to think or talk about healthcare with anybody but a doctor. And this is added in hassle. And of course, people are still going to be without healthcare during transition, you know, periods. Like if you have employer-based health insurance and then you lose it and you have to go on the exchange and switch to this Medicare for All branded insurance program, then there's still that transitional period. And of course, people don't want to think, you know, I mean, I have not, you know, not lately, fortunately, but I've been on Medicaid, and, you know, and a lot of doctors don't take that, right? There's no guarantee that they would take this. And most importantly, the whole framing of this is just based on a massive equivocation about the idea of people liking their health insurance, you know, what that really means, that somebody would like their health insurance. And by the way, if you look at the polls about this, they never use the word like. They never say, do you like your health insurance? They say, are you satisfied with your health insurance, mm-hmm. which is a very different thing. Satisfied means like, hey, you figure given the options, you know, you could be doing a whole lot worse. You're not going to complain. But to the extent that any human being might actually say you like your health insurance, well, I don't know what it would even really mean to say that you like this financial institution middleman. You know, it's certainly not, you know, some emotional attachment to it. So realistically, what that means is, well, you think that it's the cheapest option that's available to you. And of course, Medicare for All, you know, what you'd be paying in taxes, you know, would be, since it's a much more efficient way to do things, would be much less than what you're paying for, you know, insurance premiums. Or it means you like your doctor and you're afraid, of course, as we all are, that if you lose your health insurance, especially if you have regular prescriptions to refill, then the doctor that you have is going to be out of plan for your new insurance. You're going to have to wait for a really long time for your first appointment with whatever new doctor you find. And then there's going to be another appointment for the prescription. and it's a huge hassle. You like your doctor, you want to keep your doctor. But of course, once you realize that that's what liking your health insurance means, that's actually an argument for Medicare for All, right? Because under Medicare for All, the only way to go out of plan is to leave the country.
Right. Well, and theoretically, you could even, I mean, you could actually, you know, you would still have some form of, I mean, well, of course, if you're traveling, a lot of other, I remember even going to, there was a period of time where I was spending time in Trinidad and Tobago. And I remember it being really funny of like, you know, just like, I was probably pretty irresponsible about this stuff, but it was like someone's like, oh yeah, and we have healthcare here. So like if you get injured during Carnival or something, like you're good. Just remember, that's interesting. Like we, you know, like you're not even just talking right about like, yes, like the common example that like, you know, other comparably industrialized wealthy countries all have universal healthcare. It's like, no, this is also, this is a,
not just them.
Yeah. No, also a Caribbean smaller state. We've got something set up. So, and I think, you know, it's that point of emphasis of just having no worries. And I think, cause I also think that that is reflective in the polling too, that it's, yes, I think it's specifically the worry potentially about losing a doctor that somebody likes, I think is substantive. And I think even more generally, and I think what's most devious and effective of the type of thing that Biden says or Clinton says or Buttigieg says is just anything that triggers anybody's fear about their healthcare coverage, because people have been so terrorized by this just, you know, completely inhumane, immoral, you know, predator system. And these parasite companies. People are petrified of any
poll. That like, oh, this would, you know, Medicare for All would mean you would lose your existing insurance.
Yeah,
well, you know, we've all been trained to start sweating when we see that phrase, lose your insurance.
Precisely, because we've, right, and that versus saying like, hey, look, actually, first of all, here's how much the CEO of United Healthcare is making in compensation while, you know, depriving America of health and threatening you personally. And instead, what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of that nonsense and get everybody good health care. And I think that that's a really important point of emphasis. And one other example, I just really briefly, I remember in college looking at in a sociology of the European Union class, we had this printout of taxes in Denmark. And people should know, I mean, we're not, even with Medicare for All, you know, and even with free college and even with a real expansion, it still won't be the degree that it is in Denmark. You know, I just don't think that that's any time soon. And you could sit there and even as a, you know, pretty left perspective at the end of the chart, you're like, Jesus, that's a lot of taxes. But then what was immediately corresponding was like, okay, but now let's look at, okay, like here's your private health insurance bill. Here's your utility bill. Here's your rent. Here's your car payment. Here's all your stuff that is not quote unquote taxes, but is mostly just much worse quality, you know, private alternatives that are lower quality than in Denmark, much more of a hassle, and in the healthcare case can threaten your life. And it came up to basically the same amount. And so, and one objection is like, oh, well, you have a choice. But actually on most of those things, in fact, you don't have a choice, right? Like until the mandate, healthcare was probably the thing that you had the biggest choice about. And of course, that's, you know, literally putting your life in your hands. But other things like auto insurance or owning a car or many of those things are simply not functional choices in most parts of the country. If you want to like work and keep a roof over your head and own, incidentally, rent isn't a choice either. So very quickly, when you actually went over it, your obligations to worse services in the private marketplace come up to the equivalent, maybe slightly more, maybe slightly less, and almost all totally worse quality. So that's important to keep in mind as well, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And just quickly, we should really push back about this rhetoric of choice, right? You know, because if you think about what really gives people meaningful choices in life, right? If we're talking about people's freedom to live their lives the way they want to live it, I think that like choosing between Aetna and Blue Cross Blue Shield is not like high up on the list.
Right. Maybe having healthcare and housing and the ability and even, oh, God forbid, power over your economic life in a democratized economy so you can actually fulfill and pursue your potential in a real sense is somehow more liberating than sitting down and saying, ah, maybe Aetna will slightly terrorize me less than United Health or Blue Cross or whatever. Right. Maybe so. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, right now, as long as most people are getting, you know, even if we do have some kind of public option for those who aren't, as long as most people are getting their insurance through their employers, that's a massive, like, piece of power that those employers have over them. Because, you know, you have, like, everybody has this experience. It's so normal, we don't think about it, that, you know, you're worried, oh, if I lose my job, then, you know, and I don't get another one right away, then I am going to be without health insurance, or my kids are going to be without health insurance. Or even if I do get a new job right away, I'm going to have to go through this ridiculous, stressful process, figuring out a new doctor and all that stuff. And that gives people a massive incentive to stay at bad jobs.
Right. Actually, we just want to get a couple more things in the last couple of minutes. But attached to that, and there's a great book by Rob Larson called Capitalism versus Freedom that really, really makes the case mm-hmm. quite clearly and succinctly that actually in a functional and actual sense, capitalism is anti and antithetical to freedom in many substantive instances like the employment and healthcare example you're talking about. Like if we're using that word in a real sense, not a, you know, Milton Friedman, yeah. like, oh, well, you know, anybody could buy a BMW if you just chose to go without food for a year, you know, like that type of nonsense that, you know, passes for argument, the libertarian and neoliberal worlds. Yes, Matt.
I mean, capitalism just means capitalists decide and not people.
Right. Right. Precisely. So on top of that, then I want you to, you know, what is it, you know, so much of this debate, and I almost want to cool it down in a way of like, I there's many things I like and respect about Elizabeth Warren. I will say very clearly yeah. on foreign military policy, I do not like her views. And I actually think I have right. extreme disagreements and I think it is just a fundamental problem that people don't take those things as seriously. I think you have absolutely a global obligation to consider how foreign policy is going to be managed, especially because that's actually, and this is a big problem to this, but the reality is that that's the most power that a president has out of the gate. And there's very little and a lot on the other hand in her record that shows me a lot of very disturbing things. But on domestic policy, yes, it's not as left as Bernie. It's, you know, again, I just don't buy that debate, but a lot of really great stuff. And absolutely somebody who I think has genuine progressive, genuine anti-Wall Street credentials. But I like this frame that you and I have been talking about, that it's not just that Bernie's a better candidate. It's that he's different. It's something distinct in terms of the type of actual structural potential. Could you just elaborate that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean it's not, you know, it's not a question of being, you know, of which candidate is better, you know, in terms of like pure quantitative differences on the same scale. Bernie sees politics in a fundamentally different way than the other candidates do. He comes out of a socialist tradition. He started out, you know, his political life in the Young People's Socialist League, very influenced by the tradition of Eugene Debs. And, you know, of course, he's been, you know, he's been in Washington for a long time, like moderated certain views, but he still fundamentally sees politics in terms of clashes between different groups that have different interests. And mass mobilization is the thing that you need to get things done. But he has... Like when he was asked that ridiculous question at the debate about all these other states that have supposedly tried to do Medicare for all at a state level, and it hasn't worked, which is, you know, total nonsense, false premise. Those are all states that were blocked from ever trying to implement it in the first place by usually conservative Democrats. But the great part of his answer, the part that really goes to your question, is he said, no, we're going to get it done the same way that we got civil rights done, all these other things that, you know, you need to have mass engagement. And a lot of people who are, you know, who are centrists will sort of say, oh, this is a fairy tale. It's not going to happen. You're not going to get, you know, this sort of like large numbers of people who are going to be involved in grassroots mobilization to sort of push the programs that he's talking about. But then if that's a fantasy, then how much more of a fantasy is like what Biden is pushing, which right. is, oh, I'll be able to get this incrementalist stuff done because the Republicans will like come to their senses as soon as Trump is out of office, that, you know, that they'll decide to be reasonable again, right? You know, which he somehow believes after having been Obama's vice president for 8 years. So this is a really fundamental difference, you know, that like that Bernie, you know, Bernie Sanders is somebody who doesn't, you know, think that the problem is that we don't have a good enough plan, right? That's the
right.
Elizabeth Warren slogan, you know, she's got a plan, and, you know, and some of these plans really are very nice, but I think Bernie has an understanding that the problem isn't that we don't have a good, well enough, technically worked out plan for what the policy would look like. The problem is that there are these fundamental structural impediments to making it happen.
So that's just undoubtedly true. And it's true to the point that actually Warren herself has actually tried to start pivoting, and she did in the debate at least, of how are you going to do this? And she said, I'm going to mobilize people. So that's another area, you know, that's another Bernie lead on this issue. And I think obviously, I think another argument for Sanders is that he already does have the movement army in a way that's distinct and unparalleled as of this point. But I think and I will say in Biden's case, just to address that for a second, what will happen in Biden's case is that he could collaborate with Republicans on cutting Social Security and Medicare, which he proposed in the Obama administration. And then with his current attitude, let him launder themselves and all of the same people who are 100% aligned with the Trump white supremacy agenda and terrorizing Ilhan Omar, you know, sit in the Rose Garden with Joe Biden and all act like they're decent people. So, you know, in that case, his message is incredibly pernicious. But I guess the thing, and I think, you know, frankly, particularly some members of this audience, what's your case to people who say, and I still see this, you know, even people who watch and listen to my show, they might even understand on some level this argument, but they don't want it to be that way. In other words, they'll say like, you know, and this is another difference I think that you can see is that some people sort of see that like, you know, what Sanders is saying, and again, clearly in a very moderate way, right? But he said there's some understanding that like, it isn't just corruption or lack of regulation.
Right.
There is a structure, you know, capitalism has a tendency to monopoly. And at the very least, you need countervailing forces. And certainly you need to totally decommodify certain areas like healthcare. Now, Warren has somewhat gone in the direction on some of those issues, but there still seems to be an attachment and an idea among the supporters that somehow, you know, they don't want to go that far. They want it to be somehow this sort of middle of kind of reform without transformation in a way. And I just wonder if you're speaking to somebody who kind of has that view. I mean, what's your best use of argument and logic for adopting more of the structural Bernie movement view over the progressive technocratic one?
Yeah, well, I would certainly say that if you look at the empirical evidence from, you know, the last couple of decades, you know, of attempts to do any kind of incremental, you know, reforms, that should tell you something about the impediments that exist. But it's a very hard argument to make because the very thing that makes Bernie better positioned to actually push a lot of this stuff through is the very thing that makes a lot of these people think that Warren is a more serious candidate. That the thing that, like, the fact that Warren, you know, is very focused on the kind of wonky technical details of what the plan looks like, and she's more reluctant to make a harder pivot towards seeing things in terms of movements, is what, you know, makes her less likely to be able to get this stuff done. I mean, quite apart from the fact that, you know, even when it comes to some of the goals, you know, like, there are still some really significant differences there, right? You know, that, like, as there's a great article in Jacobin about how, you know, Elizabeth Warren has a plan for everything except for healthcare, for example.
No, she's that's been a real question mark over that, for sure. And of course, student debt cancellation. She put out a good, solid liberal plan. Bernie's, no bullshit. Let's just get rid of it. Right? Like, nothing complicated, nothing wonky. Let's just liberate people from that.
And the thing is, objectively, that's much better politics, like, quite right. Apart from the fact that it's a better policy, that, like, there's abundant evidence that means-tested programs are a lot more politically vulnerable than universal programs. That, you know, if there's some kind of cutoff, no matter where you put the cutoff, you're going to get gray area cases, and you're going to get people who not unreasonably think, hey, this other guy is only doing a little bit worse for me. How come I have to pay to cancel his debts, but nobody's canceling my debts, right? You know, like, that's a gift to the Republicans, you know, because that gives them talking points to push back against it. There's a reason why, you know, I mean, means-tested programs, people can convince themselves, I'm never going to need it. This benefits some other people. You know, anything that's complicated, that's hard to explain. There's a reason why the Republicans before Trump spent years symbolically repealing Obamacare, and they could still win elections after that. Whereas in countries like Canada and the UK, even conservatives have to pretend to support the maintenance of those socialized systems, or they would never win elections. Because if everybody benefits from a program, everybody has a stake in it. You know, which of course doesn't mean that wealthy elites won't try to push back against it, but it's going to be so much harder for them to do so. And again, this goes to the difference, because if it's technically complicated, if it's means tested, if, you know, maybe you get full forgiveness for this group and partial forgiveness for that group, that, you know, to people who are trained to think about politics in a technocratic way, that makes it sound like a much more serious adult kind of policy, even though objectively it's much worse politics.
Right.
So
it's worse on the merits too. Because again, it's like,
yeah,
first
as well as worse on the merits.
Right. Because
First
of all, I mean, if you're dealing with something like the student debt crisis, why not, you know, for just err on the side of getting, I mean, you're not going to, don't worry. Like, even if you're like obsessed with some like wealthy scion getting away with something, guess what? They already got away with something because they have no debt, because they were born in the lucky sperm. They were in the lucky sperm club. Right. And then even beyond that, like, you know, yeah, actually expand in the other direction and realize that even people who have, you know, very privileged circumstances, relatively speaking, like, even just in a narrow economic sense, like, yeah, I actually would prefer a young doctor not have a third of their income eaten up by paying off predatory loans. I would actually, prefer that circulate in the economy. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. As a matter of what's going to be good for stimulating the economy, as a matter of basic justice. Like, there's no, you know, just because somebody has an upper middle class job, that doesn't actually mean that it's okay that they should be, you know, in debt slavery, you know, to these parasitical lenders. Like, that's, you know, like, which is really, you know, I always, you know, like, I always liked one of the hosts on Chapo Trap House, you know, once summarized this point by saying that, you know, one of the nice things about being a socialist as opposed to being a liberal is that you get to stop worrying about who deserves what. You could just say every bastard deserves better.
100%. So, yeah, that's great. Right, exactly. No, that's perfectly put.
You know, and that's just such a more affirming human attitude. It's so much better on that level but it's also something that it's going to be easier to build popular support for. People understand it. It's simple. And also, again, if everybody understands they benefit from it, you know, there's a reason why political and media elites have been openly fantasizing about cutting Social Security for decades, but it's been very difficult for them to actually do anything in that regard because there's a huge backlash because everybody benefits from it. And of course, if, you know, even as a matter of policy, as a matter of justice, if you say, oh, it's bad that, you know, you're paying for the student loans or the health care or the higher education of rich people, well, hold on, why not embrace that argument to, you know, consistently? If that's bad, then shouldn't we means test Social Security like right wing Republicans want us to?
Well, or if that's bad, why don't you propose a wealth tax? You know, more to the point.
Yeah.
Ben Burgess is author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. I love this book, and everybody I know who's read it has loved it. He teaches logic he's been teaching at Rutgers. He has a new appointment that I think will be unveiled soon. He's taught across the United States and in South Korea. And he has a Patreon page as well, which people should definitely join. I've joined it. Ben, and The Debunk on TMBS. Ben, I really appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much. All right, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Subscribe. Check out the AM Quickie. Sam is very excited about that. The AM Quickie with Lori Steiner and I. The things that you need.
It's Lucy Steiner.
Excuse me. What did I say?
Laura Steiner.
I'm sorry. I do know it's Lucy Steiner. I actually know a Laura Steiner. So I apologize for that slip up. But seriously, though, do check that out. It's a great condensed way of basically getting your start in a substantive way on the news of the day. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Check out the Majority Report blend. Spread all of the words. This coming Tuesday on the Michael Brooks Show, Crystal Ball joins us, and then also Joshua Kahn with more practical lessons for tactics, organizing, activism, work on climate change, and First Nations rights. On our last show, among many other things, we talked about redefining and enlarging human rights and post-imperial foreign policy with Daniel Bessner. This Sunday, a primer on the Sudanese Communist Party and what's happening in Sudan right now with Ahmed Cabello. Really interesting stuff. Patreon.com/TMBS. Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Subscribe now. We're first and foremost, obviously, the Patreon, but I will say that we're I think we're 30-something or 40-something away from our first 57,000 subscribers on YouTube. So go over there and click a subscribe. Matt, Literary Hangover.
A Literary Hangover, pretty upcoming on the podcast is going to be James Fenimore Cooper. That won't be out this Saturday. That will be out next Saturday. We're doing The Pioneers, which is sort of his first one. His dad was he created Cooperstown. Yeah, so that's the Cooperstown where baseball was not, in fact, invented. And we go into how the sort of Last of the Mohicans novels is James Fenimore Cooper sort of rewriting his own sort of family history after his dad sort of went bankrupt and all of his holdings got liquidated in the 1820s and stuff like that. But in the 1880s and stuff, his dad was a town founder and a sort of minor aristocrat, self-taught. Because he swallowed up a bunch of loyalist lands in New York after the revolution. Mm. So we're going to be talking about the pioneers, but subscribe to YouTube because I'm about 27 patrons away from when I said I would start doing some video game streaming, and that's probably going to be on YouTube initially. And so you'll want to check that stuff out there. And I'm also going to get the episodes. There's two more episodes that need to be put up there. They should be up there in the next couple of weeks.
Awesome. Calls and IMs are open. Ton to get to. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back.
And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Danner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break for people.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, folks, fucking reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black. African. And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on!
Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are back. Africans are black.
Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.